Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matt Coward-Gibbs, one of the channel's hosts. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Sam Han, who will be discussing his new book, Interfacing Death, Life in Global Uncertainty. Sam is a senior lecturer in anthropology and sociology at the University of Western Australia. As an interdisciplinary social scientist, Sam's work reaches across social, cultural, critical theory, new media studies, and religion. As well as his new monograph, which we'll be discussing today, he is the author of Technologies of Religion, Spheres of the Sacred in a Post-Secular Modernity, Web 2.0, and Navigating Technomedia, Caught in the Web. Sam, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Matt. I appreciate it.
I was wondering then if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so even though, as you noted in your introduction, which was very nice, thank you, I am based in Perth, Western Australia. As you can probably tell by my accent, I'm not from Australia. I grew up in New York City, and I did my PhD in New York City at the City University of New York. And then afterwards, I moved to Singapore, and I taught at a Nanyang Technological University in the Department of Sociology over there for 6 years. And then I made my way over here to Perth. So I just realized this. I've lived and taught on three different continents, although it doesn't seem all that, it doesn't seem like I have, because it seems sort of very kind of connected somehow. But yes, so I've kind of been, I grew up in New York and I lived in New York for 30 some odd years. And then I've kind of moved to the other side of the world. And with each move, I seem like I'm getting, farther and farther away.
That's great to hear. So I was wondering then if you could begin by telling us a little bit about how you actually came to write Interfacing Death.
Yeah, so I'm in sociology and I'm a trained sociologist, although the discipline here at the University of Western Australia is combined anthropology and sociology. So my identity is as sociologist, but I'm not one of these disciplinary flag wavers. I've never felt really comfortable in sociology, so to speak, I had a very sort of ambivalent relationship with the discipline. As I mentioned, my training was done in the States, and of course, American sociology is a very sort of unique brand of sociology, if I could put it that way, or maybe genre would be a better way of putting it. As many people across the world would probably recognize, American sociology is highly quantitative, although there is a very strong sort of ethnographic tradition as well. And as someone who has always been interested in social theory, I've always been in sociology out of convenience, so to speak, and less so because I thought sociology was all that special. That's probably heresy to a lot of people. But for me, this goes back to when I was an undergraduate. I had the great fortune of studying with a sociologist named Charles Lemmert, who was, and I think still is, one of the premier social theorists in America. And, I didn't go to that particular college. I went to Wesleyan University, which is a small liberal arts college in Connecticut. I didn't go there to study with him. I had no idea who he was. It happened that I was interested in sociology. And then I sort of, I was taken under his wing. But from very early on, I was interested in theory. So I kind of pursued classes that dealt with theory. So I was a double major in sociology and literature. And in literature, of course, I was dealing with theory there as well. So I kind of ended up in sociology because, the people who were most receptive to what I was interested in were there, but that not because I had some kind of a particular understanding of sociology and what it meant to be a sociologist. I say all that because I'm very proud of my positioning as a theorist. And this probably has more to do with, as I said, my kind of formation in the United States in a kind of context where theorizing in the discipline is not really valued as it used to be. In fact, I would still say today, American sociology really consists of kind of marginalizing theory or kind of using theory as garnish, as I like to say. It can't be the main thing. It's got to be the thing you sprinkle on top. And I find that to be sad. And I didn't like that. And in fact, I didn't know that until I reached grad school, where I was sort of socialized and professionalized into the discipline. And I realized, oh, I guess what I thought I was doing, which was sociology to me, was sort of considered by many as kind of marginal and niche. In thinking about my work generally, I've always kind of seen myself as a theorist. And that's sort of my approach. My approach is always going to be theoretical. And for a lot of people, that smacks of sort of an allergy to empiricism or empirical work. I don't think that's the case at all. To me, I treat theory as a sort of hermeneutic. So my previous works have always been theoretical in the sense that I'm interested in theoretical debates and discussions, but I'm still looking at specific objects or specific phenomena. And this work, Interfacing Death, emerges out of, I guess, the previous 6 or 7 years where I was working in a interdisciplinary field that I guess I would call sort of like cultural and media studies of religion. So at the City University of New York, I studied under three amazing scholars. My primary supervisor was a social theorist by the name of Patricia Clough, who's very kind of important in, I would say, affect theory and bringing affect theory to bear on sociology. And I also studied under, I would still consider one of the kind of last great, living Marxists. Actually, no, that's not true. I mean, but there are others, but I would put him in, the top three living Marxist theorists in the world, Stanley Aronowitz. And so those are people who I thought were, who did theory and were proud of it. So I sought those people. And anyway, I bring that up because my sort of previous work and my doctoral work had been the study of technology use among American Christians. And that's sort of where I got to thinking about both digital culture and also matters of religion. And I wrote two books on this topic, one which is called Technologies of Religion. And the one that came out before then, although it would have been completed after, is a book called Digital Culture and Religion in Asia, which I co-wrote with my former colleague in Singapore, Kamaluddin Mohammed Nazir. And those two books were kind of investigating, the nexus of religion and technology. And I was always interested in how people were always surprised that religious folks, whether they be Christians from Oklahoma in the United States or Muslims from Indonesia and Malaysia, were really into technology, because I think a lot of people assume that very religious folks are kind of anti-modern. And being anti-modern means that you're not interested in streaming your worship services and connecting via YouTube sermons, etc., which I might note is very topical today. So, yes. So that got me started on kind of this religion and media stuff. And then finally, when I was kind of done with those two works, I thought, well, I want to transition to sort of the nexus of media and religiosity. So not necessarily institutional religion, but things that could be considered religious that are not necessarily religious per se. And I thought about death as sort of that perfect area to kind of pursue. Death is still today, I would say, in kind of secular, post-secular societies, but also highly religious societies, treated as sort of sacred still. Death is all, when someone passes away, the mood is very somber. There's a certain kind of protocol and offering condolences. And I thought, well, you know, death still, you know, bears some kind of sacred notion, I think, today. And I thought, oh, why not kind of continue this kind of cultural and media studies of religion, but kind of turn it into cultural and media studies of religiosity or post-religion. And that's how I kind of came, that's how I arrived at death and digital culture as sort of the topic of the book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It kind of, it makes me think of a colleague of mine, Ruth Penfold Mounts, and her almost soundbite in her recent volume of that idea that death matters. Mm-hmm. And that no matter how hard we try, death is always part of everyday life and everyday culture.
That's right. And I thought, you know, it was, I thought death, like religion, was kind of treated as sort of over and done with. And that doesn't mean that people stop dying, obviously, but you know, as a result of modernity, we were supposed to have been kind of done with religion and also done with death. That is to say, death was no longer something that kind of gave us meaning in a central way. Death was no longer that which was supposed to be explained. We understood death to be a natural process, and there were ways in which we sort of medicalized and scientified death. So I thought death and religion sort of had a structural equivalent. They had kind of equivalent positions in the narrative of modernity. So I thought that was sort of ripe. But as you said, your colleague is right. Death sort of is always there with us because it's sort of, you know, that's the phrase, right? Death and taxes. Those are the two things that are guaranteed.
No, absolutely. So I was wondering then if you might give the viewers and the listeners here an overview of the kind of content of the book.
Right. So the book is sort of, it's trying to do a lot of things at the same time. But one of the things that I try to do is to sort of recover the notion of the interface. The interface is something that I take from media studies, in particular the work of Alex Galloway, but also others like Mark Hansen, and various other media theorists who've been interested in the work of Deleuze on the one hand and Levinas on the other. And my argument here is that death has not gone away in kind of contemporary times, but that death has been mediated in a particular fashion. And for me, the particular theory of mediation that I hold on to or that I try to present is the theory of the interface for reasons having to do with the way in which we sort of digitally interact with each other and ourselves. So what I try to do throughout the book is sort of lay out this idea that death has not gone away, that it doesn't simply exist in hospitals and hospices, but that death is ever present. And that's really in media today, right? So I kind of begin with this position that death is pervasive and that we're dealing with death more than ever. Because of the specific sort of media situation that we find ourselves in. And then I sort of go through chapter by chapter kind of examples of this or instances of this. And I try to have a sort of global perspective in doing this. And this is something that I tried to sort of tackle in my introduction. It's not, you know, as the subtitle says, Life and Global Uncertainty, I tried to make the book global in perspective. And of course, that's sort of it's a tall task, obviously, because by global, you're giving the reader this idea that you're covering the entire world. Obviously, that's not the case. It's sort of comparative in the sense that each empirical chapter goes back and forth between a set of questions that are rooted in that are kind of culturally rooted in either East Asia or in the West. And I try to go back and forth. And this is, I fully acknowledge, a sort of antiquated way of doing things. This sort of smacks of the old way of thinking about sort of East-West studies. And I know there are still places and research centers that are called East-West. And, you know, that has a very specific sort of history in academia, I understand, which traces back to the Cold War. But I wanted to sort of, you know, kind of have a work that's comparative without calling itself comparative. Because of course, in sociology, as you well know, Matt, there's a whole kind of field called comparative historical sociology, which I don't do. I'm not trained in that tradition. So what I tried to do is sort of go have a sort of a Northeast Asian chapter and the sort of a Western chapter. And the reason why I picked Northeast Asia is because I've done a lot of empirical work on Northeast Asia. So that's sort of out of convenience, really. So I kind of look at the way in which death and digital culture come together, or how death is interfaced through digital culture in kind of various phenomena or examples. So one of the chapters, for instance, I explore online suicide pacts in Korea and Japan. And your listeners may or may not know this, but Korea and Japan have had some of the highest youth suicide rates, or just suicide rates generally, in the OECD. They kind of trade first and second position in the high suicide rates in the OECD. And one of the interesting things about suicide in those contexts is that youth suicide is very high. And all the kind of work that's come out of both South Korea and Japan has kind of focused on how youth suicide is very different from the kind of forms of suicide that take place in the United States or in Europe. That's because in Korea and Japan, there's a phenomenon called the online suicide pact. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Young folks with kind of suicidal ideation, instead of sort of going on to end their own lives on their own in a sort of individualized fashion, they go on the internet to various forums and they ask others to join them and to kind of commit a pact. So that is to say, they want to kind of die together, which is the title of the chapter. And I bring that up, obviously, in order to discuss the kind of classic Durkheimian framework for understanding suicide that exists in the social sciences. And for Durkheim, obviously, that has to, you know, suicide was directly kind of correlated to anomie. And I wanted to kind of bring up the fact that in Japan and Korea, what's occurring is a kind of exertion of collectivity, not a withdrawal from the social, actually, but a kind of an assertion of the social in suicide. And I thought that would kind of open up a lot of different discussions around not only the kind of Durkheimian analytic that exists in kind of Western understandings of suicide, but also I think the way in which a digital culture is, for various reasons, social. And I wanted to sort of explain that. And I want to shout out my co-author there, Amalin Hussein, who I wrote that with. And then I move on to other sorts of similar kind of similar topics or topics that are like that. So the next chapter is on selfies, on killer selfies. And I'm sure you and the listeners are aware that killer selfies is sort of a phenomenon where because of the widespread availability of front-facing phones, front-facing cameras on mobile phones, people go to kind of extreme lengths to get the perfect selfie. And the killer selfie is how the public health literature has described the deaths that result from people trying to take selfies in very sort of dangerous places. And I try to sort of use that as an opening to discuss personhood and ontology there. So with the killer selfie, I tried to suggest that there's a way in which we are exerting not so much a kind of unified self, but a self that is sort of fragmented. And I draw from the Deleuzean literature here of the individual. That's sort of where I take that discussion. I'm also interested. I've also sort of written on celebrity deaths and celebrity mourning, and I do that through the investigation of a particular celebrity death, the death of a Korean actress named Choi Jin-shil, and I try to look at her death through the lens of course, on the one hand, the classic media events literature, Dying and Cats, but also Civil Religion by Robert Bella. And I try to see the way in which her death galvanized a certain kind of nationalism in South Korea at the time. So, of course, I'm still interested in the way in which death does social things or enacts certain forms of collectivity and sociality. And then the following chapter is on terrorism and on beheading videos and what sort of what that does. And I guess, the kind of the rash of videos that Daesh or ISIS had released made me think of how we understand death and the beheading video as a particular sort of genre and what that does to kind of spectacle theory on the one hand, but also thinking about the ways in which terror is understood through a particular kind of death. And that sort of leads to the following chapter, which is on the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei and the way that his work commemorates death. So in that chapter, I investigate Ai's work, which I call his kind of memorial work. So Ai is very famous for being critical of the Chinese state. And I look at not only his sort of artworks and installations, there's a very famous one involving backpacks. So after a very sort of devastating earthquake in China, one of the things that was even more devastating was to learn that children were killed as a result of shoddy construction of their schools. And the way in which I critique the state and critique the kind of development that the Chinese state was engineering and the lack of government standards in buildings, I kind of put together a bunch of children's backpacks, right? And that's very powerful. And I look at that, but also the way in which I uses Twitter and the way in which I kind of self-broadcast to kind of galvanize a certain kind of political critique. The final sort of empirical chapter is on the way in which we understand tragedy. That is to say, how do we understand tragedy as we see more and more bodies pile up? And the two examples I look at in that chapter are Black Lives Matter, in particular, the troubling footage that was circulated of the death of Philando Castile in Minnesota, where his partner, after he was pulled over and subsequently shot by a police officer, Facebook Live the whole ordeal. And then I also look at the circulation of the image of the young boy Alan Kurdi, who washed up on the shores of Turkey. And I try to look at the way in which we understand the migration crisis. So that last chapter is on how we understand tragedy and whether tragedy really sort of still matters today as a way of kind of mobilizing questions around social change and justice, et cetera. So that's sort of my book in summary. And the conclusion isn't really a conclusion. It's a kind of a last bit on biopolitics and necropolitics and thanatopolitics. That is to say, the kind of the discussion that Foucault opens up around, to let live and let die in that amazing piece on governmentality, I think today is sort of the discussion is around exactly that. Who gets to die and who gets to be mourned and who gets to have a dignified death and all that. So, yeah, that's sort of my book in a nutshell there, Matt.
Thank you. And I think that's really interesting, that idea of who gets to die and who gets to be mourned. I think that actually draws me up to something you mentioned very interestingly in the actual introduction of the volume. You say something along the lines that digital culture bears the brunt of what is wrong with the world today. I think that's a really interesting idea, kind of read. I think you read it along the lines of kind of folk devils and moral panics in the kind of opening of this argument. And I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on that for me.
Yeah, so that sort of, for the American listeners, you'll know, I'll explain why this is kind of unique to America. I sort of end that section with a little bit on Joe Scarborough. Joe Scarborough is a morning news show host in America for a channel called MSNBC, which is sort of seen as a left-leaning channel. And the reason I bring that up is because Scarborough had tweeted something about video games and how millennials because they're so, and because millennials are digital natives, and millennials sort of live their entire lives on the screen, are so busy playing war kind of military video games and not thinking about serving their countries in actual war. And what I took from that was this idea that the digital was sort of ruining us, A, but also removing us from understanding what is important in life. And for Scarborough, what was important in life was death, real death. Real death that you experience or you witness when you serve in the military, as opposed to the sort of fake death that you only kind of experience from afar in a Luddite fashion on kind of video games like Call of Duty, right? So,
yeah.
Right. So I saw that. I started with that because I thought the digital was always seen and is still seen today, I would say, in kind of public culture as the reason why everything is wrong. And I thought it's so interesting because I had heard so many critiques of the digital. In fact, in my previous book, Web 2.0, I have an entire chapter on the sort of backlash against digital culture. And I never read the kind of criticism until I saw Joe Scarborough's tweet of digital culture as removing us from death. And that is, and that speaks to the sort of the moral baseness of millennials. And I thought, that's interesting that the digital is not only what's wrong with the world, but because also it kind of moves us further and further away from death.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, and I think that's really interesting, especially I think you also then go on to kind of discuss the smartphone as kind of an object within this. And I think it's just fascinating how much of this kind of artifact, this piece of technology then interrelates with our kind of experiences of death, obviously within the idea of the death selfie, but especially kind of the work of the situation concerning kind of Alan Kurdi as well, and the kind of spectacle of beheading and these low quality kind of, well, sometimes low quality videos and images that are circulated via these kind of technological devices.
That's right. And I think, you know, I've been sort of meaning to write this sort of, and maybe I will later on this sort of this capture imperative. You know, I say this, I think I quote this in the book, but, you know, there's a whole ethos around pics or didn't happen, right? And this idea that because of the proliferation of a capturing device that's on our bodies and sort of always tethered to us, and many people describe leaving their phones at home accidentally as feeling naked, that we have this idea of being able to sort of not only broadcast, but share and experience things together simultaneously. And I love what you said there, Matt, because I think there's something about the sort of amateurish nature of all this. And by amateurish, I don't mean to be sort of derogatory. I mean amateurish as in it's sort of open and democratic. Everyone has access to, if you have a mobile phone, chances are that you have a camera on there. And that sort of changes the game in terms of what is shared. I think this became especially operative in the Black Lives Matter movement, where, you know, the whole kind of the circulation of images and video of police brutality did something. And this is something that I think is quite important for us to think about in relation to the previous work done in sociology on the civil rights movement. I would say, if you look at the sort of classic texts that examine the American civil rights movement, the work of Alden Morris, Douglas McAdam, even Todd Gitlin, and Todd Gitlin's book is, I think, The Whole World is Watching Us. There's an argument there. Of course, there are differences between McAdam as well as Alden Morris and others around resource mobilization and whatever. But I think one of the things that they all agree on is that the mediation of these kind of images of these activists down at lunch counters getting forcefully removed from lunch counters, dogs being, German shepherds being sort of, sicked on individuals, water hoses, these are all sort of important images that the social movement literature that examines the civil rights movement of the 60s says was very important because it sort of helped Americans understand the kind of the moral appeal of the civil rights movement. And I think today what you have is a different sort of infrastructural scenario where we don't necessarily need big news teams to cover the event. What you need is someone with a mobile phone. And I think that sort of changes the way in which these images circulate. Not necessarily for the better, I would say, but I think just generally there's a different sort of dynamic going on.
No, absolutely. And I think it kind of links back again to the subtitle of the book, Life in Global Uncertainty, and the way we're kind of working with this nature of uncertainty against kind of proof or truth that something has or is happening in that situation.
Yes, I think the theme of uncertainty, obviously I'm drawing a lot from Zygmunt Bauman, among others, but I think, uncertainty is, more than ever, the thing that sort of and this maybe is a different discussion, but I think a lot of people feel that neoliberalism as a kind of analytic category has sort of exhausted itself. I don't necessarily think so. I think it's because people have sort of abused the term. But I think one of the things about uncertainty is that it's that describes, I would say, the kind of emotional or affective costs of neoliberalism. And of course, that means that a lot of things are happening. That means kind of institutions that we could have relied on maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago are sort of crumbling before us. I say that to you as an American in particular. So I think the kind of ability to capture does something for us. I don't know exactly what to describe that as. But I think there's something about, as I keep using the term capture, I think there's something about the capture ethos that I think is directly a result of uncertainty. I've been toying recently with kind of Eric Fromm's classic notion of to have or to be, and I haven't sort of fully fleshed that out, but I think there's something to be said about having proof, having images, having pictures. And this relates not only to witnessing and sort of capturing moments of police brutality, but also, taking pictures of oneself in front of the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. Why do you, it seems like that's the whole purpose of the Mona Lisa, which is to kind of serve as the backdrop for people's selfies.
I think that's interesting because it's something that you pick up on as well, kind of, especially in the kind of penultimate chapter of the book, where you talk about this kind of medial logic of what is or is not tragic in that sense. And therefore, there's this real tension almost between newsworthiness in a traditional media sense and then also this push of almost capturing and citizen journalism, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, so that sort of, the tragic to me is sort of the way in which we used to understand these sorts of images. And of course, that's the chapter that I'm discussing, Black Lives Matter and the migration crisis in Europe in particular, but also affecting the rest of the world. Yeah, the tragic is a way of kind of framing this. And of course, the classic work in all this is Boltansky, right? Distant Suffering. And I think there's something to think about there, because as these images become more pervasive and they proliferate and they're more available, do they then dull our sort of ability to be outraged by them, to be sort of incensed by them, to be affected by them? I think Boltansky's worry, and this is in the 90s, I believe, was that the kind of the televisual image was sort of already doing that work. Now, think about where we are today, Matt. Television is so kind of quaint. If you think about it now, these images are floating around super fast across the world. And that makes me really wonder, and they're happy, you know, they're appearing before us on social media, which are not even within the kind of media logic of backwards chronology as they used to be. These are all algorithmic, right? They appear before us through, not because of what people are posting that's, you know, in our social network, but because of what various algorithms think we would like to hover over or click on. So does that kind of bring us to the limit of the tragic? Are we rethinking what it means to understand the tragic? Because of course, the tragic as a kind of genre form is directly tied to uncertainty. Tragedy is about, as a dramaturgical genre, is about the kind of attempt by individuals to skirt fate, right? To sort of take off, or to kind of, yeah, take off the yoke of fate, of certainty. And then guess what? They try and try and try. And then, you know, it's a snarling vine. It sort of grabs them by the ankle, even in spite of their best efforts. And I think today we know these sorts of tragic things happen all the time. So does that make us treat them as less tragic? Or are we just resigned to the fact that sort of tragedy is what we're dealing with all the time? I don't have a full formed answer to that. I guess this is kind of anticipating another question you'll ask later on, but that's one of the things I'm working on right now, which is a short book on tragedy.
Mm. I think that's really important as well, because especially tragedy seems so interwoven with these ideas of kind of spectacle that especially you're picking up with in your discussion of kind of terrorism and Daesh. And I was just wondering if you could maybe explore a little bit more of the way in which you're kind of using these notions of spectacle in that chapter.
Yeah. So, the theory of the spectacle has been around. Debord is the key figure, but I would even say Plato's allegory of the cave is sort of a spectacle theory. Daesh is an interesting sort of example, just because they are dealing specifically with a sort of, they're trying to create a genre. Daesh is very sophisticated in terms of its media use. Daesh is, ultimately trying to become a state. So they try to do statish things like, you know, have a police force in its territory, have an ambulance service. It's trying to function as like a state. And what it also does in its sort of beheading videos, and, you know, in the course of doing this work, I've had to watch some of this more than I would on a regular day. And you see that there is a specific kind of formal quality to these beheading videos. The orange jumpsuits, right? And that's directly a kind of reference to Guantanamo Bay and the images that were circulating of the people who were picked up by U.S. forces and then brought into Guantanamo Bay in Cuba without formal charges pressed against them. And of course, this is the era of the Bush administration that sort of created this weird territory of non-enemy combatants, whatever that means, so as to skirt the Geneva Convention. But that orange jumpsuit was a direct kind of reflection of another piece of media. So what we're dealing with Daesh in particular is a kind of intertextuality, I would say. And Daesh tries to make their video short enough so that it could appear on evening news shows in the West. So Daesh is directly sort of responding to the kind of formal qualities and aesthetic kind of characteristics of Western news. And that to me is creating a particular kind of spectacle, but a spectacle that's sort of ready to be circulated. And the beheading is, of course, a way of thinking about sort of as a way of playing into the West's understanding of Daesh's sort of appeals to, you know, the so-called caliphate or whatever. So the kind of tropes of quote unquote barbarity that the Western news media sort of ends up using is precisely what Daesh in those videos is trying to play up. Not to mention the fact that for a long time, these Daesh videos were hosted by someone who had the nickname, I believe, from the UK tabloids of Jihadi John, who had a London accent and was clearly a UK national. And I think Daesh did this on purpose. And I believe, and I'm not sure if this is the case, the language, the other kind of languages that Daesh operated with was also very specifically kind of French, I'm thinking of, was a very sort of kind of specific kind of like not only regional French, but also very specifically locatable French. So as to say, our fighters are from the core of the metropole, so to speak. So yeah, it's not simply spectacle as in spectacle, like, wow, it's spectacular, it's a singular event. It's a spectacle as in it's a genre, and it's a spectacle that's sort of clearly kind of drawing on all kinds of media sources. So I was trying to think of, I was trying to kind of rethink spectacle theory as beyond the kind of singular spectacle, but as sort of the long array of spectacle, so to speak.
No, absolutely. And it's making me also think of kind of narrative journalistic accounts as well. I think there's one American Jihadi, I believe it's called, that kind of tells this narrative of an American national who is within kind of the a terrorist organization, this name I can't quite remember off the top of the head, but they're kind of voice calls and conversations. So there's almost a more of a humanization and a personalization that is taking place within these, that's kind of helping form that genre and that kind of almost parasocial interaction to an extent, which you pick up on in the kind of previous chapter.
Yeah, that's right. I think that kind of parasociality, which I discuss through celebrity, but I think this exists here as well. That's a very good point, Matt, because you know, the idea of having someone with a kind of you know, London accent is a very deliberate choice. Obviously, it's a kind of call to other disaffected youth to say, hey, you know, come join our cause, so to speak. And what's so interesting, I think, is especially in the case of the kind of journalistic accounts of American jihadis, is they always begin from their childhood. You know, they say, oh, they grew up in a very sort of regular, typical American childhood. And of course, typical American is highly racialized, highly classed, you know, and this what we're supposed to do as an audience is to be like, wow, you would never expect those people who could be our neighbors, who would be prototypical Americans, to kind of join the cause. Whereas I think with figures like Jihadi John, I think it has a very different sort of effect, which is to say the people who are living in specific neighborhoods of Brussels, of London, of Paris, yeah, you know, some of these folks may end up wanting to join the cause, right? So that's, I think there's a bit of a difference there on either side of the Atlantic. But I think nevertheless, there is a kind of, that's part of the spectacle as well, right? It's not simply the beheading video that is spectacle, but it's the kind of the consequences of that. And that circulating that also is part of that spectacle. And you know, to address this, I use the work of the art historian W.J.T. Mitchell, right? This is the kind of bio picture, right? The image. Mm-hmm. As not only the image itself in terms of content, but, you know, the kind of forms of distribution.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, it's almost like when we then consider the case of kind of Alan Kurdi, we're almost seeing that take place in reverse, especially in more kind of right-leaning media within Europe that the migration crisis was very difficult. But then you see this kind of idea of innocence, of childhood lost as well. And that almost, again, renders this kind of way of interacting more closely and more actually humanizing rather than dehumanizing.
Right. And I think, you know, this brings back something you noted earlier, which I didn't quite address, which is about vulnerability. Who gets to be mourned? Who doesn't? Right. And I think the figure of the child is very important here. You know, I chose Alan Kurdi because that's an image that I think a lot of people are familiar with. But I think, you know, in particular with the migration crisis in Europe, the images of children are very much deployed. The images of women with children are deployed as well. And I think this is something that is quite quite obvious because on the one hand, there is a kind of attempt by, you know, I would say maybe sympathetic media is not the right word, but media who are trying to sort of give a human face to this issue of migration, which in Europe, as you note, has been sort of the fault line and the sort of the basis for a lot of you know, nasty nationalism and fascism even. But I think there's something to be said about children in this regard, the images of children. I have an honor student right now who's doing a project on medical volunteerism. So not necessarily volunteerism, but this thing where, you know, you can go in for like a week or two and do some kind of volunteer work in parts of, and because I'm situated in Australia, you know, a lot of folks go to Southeast Asia. And of course, on their websites, they detail how much work they do and who benefits from this work. And it's inevitably children. It's inevitably brown children. So I think there's a certain kind of a way in which vulnerability and even humanity is still racialized in a particular way.
No, absolutely. That's fascinating. Well, Sam, we've taken up a lot of your time already. So I suppose what I'd like to do to draw to a close now is to just ask you our traditional final question. So you've already mentioned that you're working on a short book about tragedy, but could you tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now and where this project is taking you next?
Yeah. So as a result of writing this book, I really, especially that tragedy chapter, I thought, wow, like, you know, there's so much more I wish I could say. So then I thought, you know what, maybe I write a short book. I like writing shortish books anyway. And I feel like there hasn't been a kind of short book on the importance of the concept of tragedy for the social sciences. So I have a book proposal in with a publisher, and hopefully that'll be looked at soon, on the importance of tragedy for the social sciences. That's at least the working title. And I thought, okay, so where would I begin with all this? Of course, there's a classic work of Nietzsche, but then I realized that, you know, the kind of Max Weber has this idea of sociology as secular theodicy, right? And what is theodicy? Theodicy is kind of the way in which religions and then later, you know, society explains evil in the world. And tragedy was precisely that, right? In ancient Greece, tragedy was a way of explaining why things didn't go exactly right for all people. And that's why tragedy sort of is always kind of undergirded by this notion of fate. And I thought, oh, okay, so we have something here. We got a little bit of Nietzsche. We got a little bit of Weber. And I think today more than ever, and I've, you know, I fully acknowledge that I'm speaking to you in conditions of kind of a global pandemic where tragedy more than ever becomes a way in which we understand the world. And my kind of question would be, what are we trying to understand about the world when we call things tragic, right? So there are deaths that are tragic. There are things that are tragic. Everything seems to be tragic. Well, what do we mean by that? How does that word function? And so for me, I'm trying to sort of investigate that, but also kind of put forth the idea that sociology needs to have a certain kind of tragic vision. And this is not a new idea. Many writers have been sort of working around this notion. In particular, Terry Eagleton, his book on sweet violence, has sort of defended this kind of tragic position. And I think that's important for us, especially today, because more than ever the kind of the narrative of progress that modernity and the Enlightenment before that was supposed to that we sort of take from the Enlightenment, the idea that things are getting better is kind of under threat. So I thought, you know, especially in uncertain times, the idea of the tragic would be useful for the social sciences. So that's what I'm working on. I also have another project in the works, which also stems from this book. You know, the final chapter of this book has to do with biopolitics, and that's, of course, the politics of life. And I thought, okay, the politics of life, you know, there's, of course, the notion of biological life, but there's also other kinds of life. And I was thinking in particular of lifestyle. So I'm working on a project right now called Styling Life, where I'm kind of exploring the ways in which ethics and aesthetics sort of come together in contemporary, what I'm calling self-making. So I'm looking at sort of examples of this, not only in the sphere of wellness, but I'm also looking at it in terms of sort of YouTubers who are really kind of interested in giving advice around kind of craft. I'm looking in particular at a bunch of YouTubers who are really interested in kind of shoe maintenance and leather and leather care. And I find that to be all sort of kind of, you know, a way of exerting a certain kind of aesthetic and ethical self project. That's what I'm working on. And that sort of came out of my kind of re-engagement with the biopolitics literature, because, of course, a lot of that, and in particular, the work of Nicholas Rose is important here, because it's not only about the politics of life as in biological life, but it's about how we understand life, qualified life. I think today more than ever, we understand life as not only biological, but also as ethical and aesthetic.
Yeah, they sound really exciting, and I can't wait to hear more about them. Once again, Sam, I'd just really like to thank you for your time. It's been great to chat to you again today. And so thank you very much. And we'll be seeing you soon, I hope.
Yeah, thanks so much, Matt.